This week on the bookshelf, I'd like to pay tribute to a gentleman whose books were incredibly important to me, Walt Wengren Jr. I had the opportunity to interview him three different times. Walt died last August 5th after 77 years on Earth and lived in the land of cancer for more than 15 years. The last time we talked was about the book entitled Letters from the Land of Cancer, which we did March 14th in 2010. Today I'd like to replay that show for you as a tribute, not just because he was a great storyteller or because he was a great interview, but because he was an extraordinary man.
On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
It's our great pleasure and delight to welcome back Walt Wengren Jr. to On the Bookshelf. I was telling Walt before we got started that he has been one of my favorite authors for 20 years now, and we've had the chance to talk a few times, but his most recent book struck a particular chord with me. His new book is Letters from the Land of Cancer. It's from Zondervan Publishing House, and it begins with the discovery that things are not what he would like them to be in his body, but the discovery becomes a journey and an adventure that he invites us to travel with him. Walt, it's wonderful to have you on the bookshelf again.
Thank you, David.
When you first discovered something in your body that had not previously been there, it's right after Christmas in 2005, correct?
Right.
You did the normal things. You go to the doctor and you take your wife. And you discover that you have a stage 3 lung cancer.
Right. Over several steps we discovered that, but yes.
The most amazing thing about the book is that, although in retrospect it wasn't as amazing as it was when I first hit it, was that you are surrounded by people who are caring for you, and you are surrounded by people who are praying for you, but you are not praying for your own personal healing. And you, when you began to explain why, it made perfect sense. But when I first got to it, I thought, okay, let's hear more about this. So explain to us your concern for your wife in dealing with all of these changes, but you have an extraordinarily faithful and refreshing way of looking at this phase of your life.
Let me see if I can identify several reasons why that took place, or why it didn't. The first is, although I must say I didn't know this right at the beginning, faithfulness made me open to anything that would happen. I wasn't scared about death. I have begun to believe that our faith shows itself to us most clearly when we approach death, whether it's our own or somebody else's. But I didn't mind living, and I didn't mind dying, and for some reason it felt to me a bit presumptuous to say unto the Lord, okay, this is the thing I want. I'm praying to the Lord of life and death, of course. On the other hand, I was grateful for Than to pray, and I was grateful for others to pray, because they can pray without presumption, without a kind of an arrogant, I know what's best for me. And they can do it, too, because they have double reasons for praying. Not just with regard to me and our relationship, which I think is a very blessed thing, but also with regard to themselves, though they wouldn't pray for themselves. More and more, Than and I came to believe that this death would be far harder on her than it would be on me. I'm going to, as we talk, you should know that every once in a while, my lungs are going to have to be cleared like that.
Right. And part of that is another part of this whole journey that you share with us very frankly. And while Walters is getting a little bit of a breath here, our listeners need to understand what he talks about in the book, that he has a type of condition that is related to the treatment that he was getting for the lung cancer. Is this pneumonitis?
Yes. Pneumonitis means that I have lost half capacity of the lungs. It is the treatment, I think, that did it. It turned the top half of both lungs into a kind of fibrous tissue that doesn't exchange the oxygen with the blood. But I live with that. I should tell you that at one point I complained to my father, who was then in his 70s, about some ache that I had, and he just looked at me and he said mildly, "Get used to it." Meaning, this is what happens in our lives. Yeah. The aches come, changes come, and we get used to it.
One of the things that struck me too in your discussion of intercessory prayer is, because this, as a Christian, this is something we continually struggle with. Why do we pray? Obviously, God knows what our needs are. He knows what our desires are. And so it must be that prayer is more than just an exchange of information between unequal people.
Right.
It's got to be something that changes us. And I think that's why I understood exactly what you were talking about when you said, I don't pray for myself in this regard. Mm-hmm. Because to do so is to assume that we get special treatment because we've been good servants, or because we're college professors or pastors or whatever. And I'm amazed. I'm bivocational also. I serve a pair of Methodist churches, and sometimes people are surprised when they find out that I have a little bit of creeping arthritis, or that I have this or I have that. And I say, well, goodness, I don't know why you're surprised. I wasn't surprised. I knew it was coming. You know, if you live long enough, things are going to not work the way that you've always come to expect them to be. That's part of the adventure of getting older.
Right. Let me touch upon something that you make me think of. I'm not sure I wrote this in the book or not. Very often people will come up to me and talk about some malady they have. I remember a friend of mine who is an organist was losing the sight in one eye because her retina was detaching, and it took a very serious kind of surgery to bring it back. We would talk in the morning. If I'm going to preach, she would come early, and we always found that an excellent time because we were going to share in leading worship. And she would talk about the difficulty of her sight, what it did to her organ playing and so forth, and then suddenly she would apologize to me, and she'd say, oh, how can I talk about what I'm feeling when you have such a worse thing, meaning my lung cancer?
Right.
And I began to realize, and I told her, there is no worse. It's the same, which means if she is dealing with her eyes at this moment, that for her is as much a problem as my dealing with cancer. When you look at it from the inside, there are no comparisons about this. I can, and I should be, just as sympathetic for her as she might be for me, but we don't have to make comparisons. I really want to set people free from this idea that somehow or other they should walk tenderly around those who have significant, and in this particular instance, a killing disease. They don't have to, and we, that is to say, those of us who are terminal in some respect, we have no right to think that our disease is much worse than theirs. There's a kind of arrogance in that. It's the same. If my child starts crying, or now my grandchild starts crying because she fell down and hit her head, in that moment, that hurt on her head is completely as important to her as any kind of cancer is to me. This has to do with both comforting, and it has to do with allowing people who walk tenderly simply walk truly.
In the book, you talk about you asked for forgiveness one time because you're grumpy, and you're kind of short with the lady who's at the reception area at the treatment center, and you chastise yourself and say that how dare you to behave like that, because having cancer doesn't give you the right to be a jerk.
Exactly.
I paraphrase, but that's that. And I thought, isn't that the truth? You know, we sometimes think that whatever our situation is gives us the freedom to be an unpleasant person to other people. And my wife struggled with a retina issue, just like you're talking about with your organist. And my wife plays the piano at one of the churches I serve. So it was a 2009 was a very scary year for her dealing with all of that. Mm-hmm. And she would say to me, "You don't know what it's like." And I thought, well, no, I really can't imagine how scary it is to think that maybe your sight is leaving one of your eyes.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, all of us are terminal. It's just that some of us have more of an idea of how close we are to the end of our lives here on Earth than others.
Right. I recall, and still, people will say, well, you have a right to this and that. You're obviously, you're struggling with death, and so you have a right to become, not arrogant, but pushy with other people, even if they don't understand what's going on. It was when I heard that that I began to think what you're talking about. None of us has a right to wound somebody else or to become fussy with them or undermine them or scold them. Of course, the world thinks that it grants us that, but what happens when we hurt that world? How do they take it? What do they do, especially if they don't know what's happening to us? It wounds them just as much, and it is just as much against our creed. When I say that this cancer is for me an adventure, I say that and I really mean that. Part of the adventure is to understand what happens to me when I move through these things. I said our faith most shines. I'll add to that. Our faith becomes the best witness to other people in how we confront death.
Yes.
I think that's the most witnessing that we do. But the witness means that our confrontation still meets with a kind of peacefulness on our part. It's not wrong to go back and look at the early martyrs who clearly had it tougher than any one of us does, and to notice that part of the power they had over the non-Christians who were watching them was that they did all these things peacefully.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't suddenly get upset. Their trust in God allowed them to become whole and to continue in a sweet vein, which I think is also what we're called to do.
We're talking today to Walt Wengren, Jr., who is the author of Letters from the Land of Cancer from Zondervan Publishing. Walt has been is a university professor, has been a radio announcer, book reviewer, traveled with migrant farm workers, participated in the Lakota Indian Sundance, and there was a book that came out of that experience as well, and been pastor of an inner-city church. And his first novel, The Book of the Dun Cow, won the National Book Award in 1980 and the New York Times Best Children's Book of the Year, and it's recently been produced as a Broadway show. And one of the things that Walt writes about in his book, Letters from the Land of Cancer, is that one of the regrets he had about having to deal with the treatments is that he was going to miss the premiere of this show based on his book. And I thought, that's a very normal reaction for a writer. Here you have this really exciting thing is happening to you, and you're thinking, well, how inconvenient is this? I have to go take chemotherapy and miss all of that.
Yep, I agree. I'm sorry I missed it. There is a kind of a fulfillment when what you have done enters into another kind of art altogether.
Mm-hmm.
And I could never have written such a thing. But there is. I mean, it's a fulfillment devoutly to be desired. And I'm sorry I missed it. But it went on.
Yes. And
yeah, I should say, by the way, with all this faithful talk on my part, with this comfort in approaching death, that doesn't mean I don't get sad or sorry sometimes that something is not going to be there for me. I just
right.
don't bargain with it.
It's like you talk about in the book, when you're working in your garden, and this is something you truly love. You and Thane at work together and have this amazing garden. And as you're working in the garden, you just wonder, well, will I be here to enjoy the fruits of this labor? And if not me, then at least my wife, my children, my grandchildren. Well, and I suppose in the truest sense, that's the way we really have to live our lives, isn't it? To plant trees that we will not necessarily harvest, but yet to plant them anyway,
right.
and to enjoy the process of it.
Well, this is actually the whole Old Testament view of death. No one was an individual. Nowadays, we think that the fullness of community or the fullness of life stops at our endings, our flesh. And so we're surprised. In fact, I think we can't even get our mind around the fact that in those days, the fullness of an individual was the family, and the fullness of life was through generations, so that whenever any of them died, such as Abraham or all the way down to David, they truly weren't at that point thinking of a heaven, which they didn't fully understand yet. They were thinking of their children. It's why, for example, Jacob, Israel, blessed his children, actually put his hands upon their heads, read Genesis chapter 49, and blessed them into the future. He went into that future with them, and they took with them his own trust, his feeling for the future, and, as it were, his bones.
One of the great things I would think about being a successful writer is that this is a legacy that you leave for the next generation that's already, you've already seen come to fruition. And there have been some books that you've released recently, about the same time that Letters from the Land of Cancer came out, St. Julian's and Father and Son Finding Freedom. And yet I know that the way writers work isn't you just wake up one day and say, well, I think I'll write a book about that. Okay, that's all done. Well, what am I going to do tomorrow? I think I'll start a new book. You've got things in process all the time, and that's one of the things that Thane is having to deal with. What happens with the things that Walt has started that he never got a chance to finish here?
Yeah. In fact, that's going to be, I think, for her, just a huge issue, because suddenly they're going to have to deal with copyright. She's going to have to work with some kind of a trust to understand how to handle all this. So we've invited our oldest son into this kind of a process. Let me take a step from what you said. And that has to do with our preparation for Than's life after my death. We live, as you were suggesting, on about 25 acres. There are fields here, which I work on. We have all kinds of fruit that I put up, so forth and so on. Than knows that when I die, she's not going to be able to take care of this large property. She's going to have to move into town. Mm. And so we don't know how long I have to live. It might be a while. It might not. But we need now to handle those things that Than would have to handle in the future. So we've been looking, and I think we have found a house in town where she's going to go and live. What we hope to do then is that I would know where she's going to be. There's a blessing in that. But more than that, that I might, before all this is done, live there with her for a while.
Hmm.
That way, the huge issue of purchase and sale, this property and so forth, will have been accomplished. Moreover, her sense of my presence thereafter will not be lost in a house which she has to get rid of,
right,
and in a new house. So we're working together on this whole process.
I think that's really a wonderful thing to do for her. I know that's going to make it that much more difficult for you because of your strength issues now and everything, but I do think that that's a swell idea. One of the things that I've seen so many times with people who are left behind when their spouse dies is, what do we box up? What do we give away to the kids? What do we discard? What do we do with everything? And what a great gift to help her with that, so that it may not be something that she has to deal with on her own.
I learned this from a man named Gilbert years ago. He also was dying of cancer, and it went faster for him. After he had died, his wife, I think the first thing was she had to mow the lawn. She was really worried about that. Well, she went to the lawnmower, and here was a note that told her exactly how to prepare the lawnmower from her husband. She hadn't anticipated that. The next thing was there were notes on the furnace. There were notes on everything he used to do so that she might take a step herself into handling the things that he did. Better than that, every time she found that note, and of course she was older, mm-hmm, that is to say she wasn't looking to carry on in a new way. Every time she found a note, she said, oh, here's Gilbert.
Yeah.
He's remembering me.
How, what a lovely gift. I don't know if you've seen it yet, but in the new Christianity Today, there's a review of your book by David Neff called A Chronicle of Hopeful Dying.
Hmm.
And it talks about dealing with death as a Lutheran. And you are a Lutheran. You were a Lutheran pastor. I grew up in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and so I understand what he's talking about when he's talking about the Lutheran understanding of that we are sinful people and not deserving of anything but saved by the grace of God.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to me that as I was reading your book that this is an attitude that has to sink into your bones. So that in a situation that like you're facing, a real crunch time, this is the kind of thing that you can rely on naturally, rather than trying to impose it on a rather shallow belief system that you might have previously had.
Yeah, exactly. I think that some of the things we're fortunate in is already to have, I'm going to say this as best as I can, already to have died. I remember years and years ago when I was a child, actually I was watching a movie, and it occurred to me there were two people in the war who were behind a hill, and there was no, and they were prepared to go over, and it was because they had already died. Nobody could hurt them from that death. And I said, I mean, at that point it dawned on me, to have died once is to set you free for every other kind of death. And even though it is my faith that that we have died into Jesus Christ. That's what the gospel writers say, you know.
Right, die to self.
Yeah, and the death into Christ means that all that I have been, all that I want to be, is in fact bound up in my Lord. I want to say something else while I have the time.
Sure.
All this sounds like I'm doing just fine with this. And in one respect, I am. And so I write and so we talk. But what you pointed out before is, I think, necessary to acknowledge. And that is that I get upset. I mean, I really do get upset. I am troubled by what I do to other people. It's not that I get scared of dying at all, but I find that the things that when I'm healthy, I can hold back, the sins that I healthily hold back, all of a sudden, what's going on in me, it creates a kind of weakness, and I don't hold it back. Mm. In other words, there is aggravation with this whole thing. I am not a sweet character throughout it all, just smiling benignly on everybody else. Those who are listening to you who have cancer know better than that. You know, I say that faith is that which is able to be kind to other people when you're sick, and that's true. But faith constantly needs renewal, and the sinner constantly needs God's mercy to return upon him or her. And so I can't just give people the notion that all of this is a sweet ride. We still are in this world, and we're still banging about, and I still have to confess my sins.
Well, and there's a phrase that you use in the book. I contain pain.
Mm.
And that's as good as an expression of the kind of pain that seems to come from every pore of your body, from weird places, from places you didn't know you had. And this is the kind of thing that I've heard plenty of other people who have cancer, and my father-in-law who died of cancer, I've seen this where there's some pain that is so intense that it really defies description.
Mm-hmm.
And your faith does not change the fact that there are times of excruciating pain.
Right, exactly. And pain can literally take your breath away. There are times when, I don't know if this is going to make sense, but I suspect it might to some, there are times when the pain is so bad I have to laugh. It's like, this is more, how can I say this? It's beyond anything I would imagine. And it seems so screwball that somehow or other, there is this pain in me. Why? Well, maybe that doesn't make sense unless you're actually in it. But I have to laugh at this extremity.
Well, it's either laugh or scream, right? So, laughing is more acceptable, even if people think you're a little off.
Yeah.
But you talk. There's one place where you talk about because I've heard people with cancer dealing with this before. The doctor prescribes morphine.
Mm-hmm.
And your wife is concerned. Well, is it, you know, are there addiction issues here?
Mm-hmm.
And he gives you such good advice and says, well, if the pain medication is doing its job, then it's not going to be addicting. It's just doing its job.
Exactly.
I think that's a great relief to read that, because I know people who are deathly afraid of taking pain medication, even when they're in when they've got bone cancer, which is just the most excruciating thing, because they don't want to get addicted to it. And that's right. That it's not you only it's only addicting if you take it because you really don't have pain to deal with.
Right. In fact, that's exactly what happened to us. yes, I took the morphine as long as I needed it. No, there was no sense that I actually had to have it. And when the pain subsided, it was quite easy for me to give over the morphine. I haven't been back to it since. So, you know, there are certain things that require bravery
right.
on our part. But it would be foolish for us not to acknowledge what's available to us now. You know, I come from Germanic stock, in which people never speak to one another about
right.
brings what's going on. They think that it's an imposition on other people to say it, and they grimly they face it. You only find out afterward that they've been sick unto death for a while. You know how sometimes this is exactly how parents keep their children in secret mm-hmm. for what's going on for them. But I don't know the value of that all the time. I wrote, and I mean this, groaning helps a lot. But I'm glad I'm living in this particular day when I can keep my intelligence. I don't have to focus always on what's going on in my body. So I'm capable, as you were saying before, to focus on writing and focus on my grandchildren. And fine, I'm glad for pain medication.
Speaking of your children, one of the things that you mentioned in that for which you were grateful is the fact that you found out about this at a time when your whole family was gathered around you, so you could tell everybody at one time, here's what we're facing, here's what's ahead.
I think it's a matter of trust, too. I trust the children to be able to receive what's going on for me. I realize, you know, I said this, too, at some point, when a doctor decides... decides not to tell the patient something because they think that the patient can't quite stand it, then they demean the patient.
Yeah.
They don't trust the patient enough to be able to accept what's going on or to make plans or any number of things which the patient is capable of doing. I think it's the same thing with our children. If they're very, very little and, well, no, my grandkids know what's going on.
Yeah.
In fact, the children are quite able to meet those things. But if we don't talk to them, then it's a kind of a dismissal of their capacity to meet things and to talk about it. It also is a break, I think, in the genuine relationship between a parent and a child.
Yes.
To hide things.
Well, Walt, we're practically out of time, and there's so many more things that we could talk about. And I just wanted to say thank you for taking time out of your schedule to visit with me and with our listeners. And to thank you again for all the wonderful words that you've written that have touched me and inspired me all these years.
Well, you're welcome. Here is the website.
Okay.
It's all one word, my name, WalterWongrenJr.org. WalterWongrenJr.org. Yeah, and in fact, that's the place. I still am periodically writing cancer letters, and so that is the place they can go.
Very good. And can we write back to you from that side? Or
no, my address is there.
Oh,
and
okay.
I'm always cheerful to get snail mail.
Okay.
thank you, Dave.
Thank you so much. If God wills, we'll get to talk again
yep.
on this side of heaven. And if not, I'll recognize you because I've seen your picture, but I hope you recognize my voice when we see each other in heaven.
Well, I got your picture right in front of me.
Oh, excellent then. We'll know each other right off.
Well, but don't wear this tie.
I won't. It was a borrowed tie anyway. Walt Wangren Jr., our guest today, his new book, Letters from the Land of Cancer from Zondervan Publishing House. And our thanks to him for being with us today. And may God continue to bless you, Walt.
Thank you.
And if you'd like to find out more about the letters and letters that he has written since the book was published, check his website, Walter Wongren Jr., that's WANGERINJR.org. It also has an address if you'd like to send him, as we call it these days, snail mail, a regular postcard or a note, let him know that you're thinking about it. Once again, our very special thanks to Walt Wongren Jr., whose book, Letters from the Land of Cancer from Zondervan Publishing House, is an extraordinary look at the way that we face death as Christians. I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for joining us. God bless.